God's Economy Applied, The Lives of Ruth and Daniel, was presented by Ron Julian on August 11, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of the teaching.
To be involved in the picture, and this is how Boaz takes it, this is how he describes it, is that his responsibility as a kinsman redeemer is not only to buy back the land, but to marry Ruth. And the question is, how did that happen? Because that's not strictly speaking what the law says. There was a practice that we refer to as leveret marriage, marrying the brother-in-law. And this is that situation where if a man dies childless, his brother has the responsibility to marry the widow and produce children in the dead man's name. So the dead man has children, his wife has children, it is considered through his brother to be like his child, and so his family line is preserved. He has passed on, it is considered as if he has passed on children in his name. But that practice, as we see it described in the Old Testament, was specifically tied to brothers. So if my brother dies and leaves a widow and there's no children, then I have this responsibility to marry her and so that he can have children. But that particular practice is not anywhere tied to this general idea of the kinsman redeemer, the nearest relative. It's my brother that is supposed to do this. And Boaz is not the brother of Naomi's husband, or he's not the brother of Ruth's husband. That doesn't really enter into this. And it's sort of interesting how complex it gets, because as the kinsman redeemer, he is restoring the land for the sake of Elimelech, Naomi's husband, but then he is not marrying Naomi, who is the widow of Elimelech. He's marrying Ruth, who is the widow of Elimelech's son. And we can say right now, I mean, you can see why it might be the case. If the idea was to pass on children, Naomi is past the age where she's probably going to have children. So marrying her isn't really going to solve anything. But Elimelech had a son who died, and he had a widow. So if you marry her, then in essence, in his line, she is of childbearing age. So if she has a child, it can be considered still that this is in the line of Elimelech that this is happening. But nothing like that in particular is described in the law. All of this is a kind of a working out in this particular cultural setting of kind of the law has its specifics, and what seems to have worked out is that they have established a certain way of understanding how all of this stuff works together. So there's a lot of scholarly debate on how to understand what's happening here. It seems to me to take the story in a way that it makes sense, that we need to take it that these ideas have been joined together. The idea of leveret marriage, which is not really what's happening here, it's not a brother-in-law who's marrying, but the idea that the kinsman redeemer, the nearest relative, it has taken on the role of preserving the family in many ways, buying the land and preserving it, marrying to preserve children in the line, and so forth, that somehow all of that has gotten wrapped up. And Boaz seems to accept that as the appropriate picture. Yeah, all right, my relative Elimelech died, so it is appropriate for me to buy his land, to keep it in his line, and to marry his son's widow so that his line will be preserved. And all of that seems to be my responsibility. So that's another one of those tricky things. What exactly is it? How is all of this stuff going together? Another question that people raise is this idea of raising up a child for someone else. It's as if it is the son of Elimelech and the son of Mahon. Is that who was his son? If you look at the way the text treats it, on the one hand, the child that results from the marriage of Ruth and Boaz is considered to be an heir of Elimelech, it's considered Naomi sees the child as in a sense hers. So this child is in that line. And yet it's interesting when we see the genealogy at the end of the genealogy of David, it is not Elimelech who's listed as the father of Obed, it's Boaz, the father. So the idea of the kinsman redeemer here, or the idea of the one stepping in to marry, was to preserve someone in the line of the relative, and yet at the same time it also seems to be understood to be in Boaz's line as well. And that's tricky. And that, in fact, may enter into some of the dynamic of what's happening in the story, is that it seems to indicate the possibility that there was a sense in which they considered it both ways, that the child of Boaz is both the child of Boaz and the child of Elimelech in different ways, depending on how you wanted to think about it. So you see that all of these things are somewhat speculative. We can't answer definitively these questions as to how they thought about this stuff. But what makes sense to me is to understand the details in such a way that the story makes sense. So if it requires that they understood it in a certain way in order for the logic of the story to make sense, then I think that's the way we should take it. So let me talk then a little bit about the story itself then, what happens here, and what's one kind of plausible way of understanding what's happening, what the point is of the story. Seems to me that in a way this story is about Naomi as much or more than it is about Ruth and Boaz. That you really have three important characters. You have Ruth, you have Boaz, but you also have Naomi. Because she really is the one that gives the overall structure to the story. She is an Israelite woman whose husband took her to Moab because of famine. And there his sons married Moabite women, contrary to what the law demanded. So having left Judah, where obviously a number of the Israelites did not leave Judah, but he did in the famine, and his sons married Moabite women, it doesn't really talk about him, but it doesn't necessarily give the impression that he was like the most faithful of Israelites. But this tragedy comes upon Naomi. She loses both her husband and her sons. And this means that she really is destitute. Because for a woman in her situation, as a widow, if her husband dies, she ought to have her sons. She ought to have other males in her family to preserve her place, to take care of her, and to give her a place in the structure of society, preserve her rights to property and all of that kind of stuff. So, but they're gone. No husband, no sons. So when her daughters-in-law want to go with her, she's basically saying, don't go with me. You go take care of yourselves in Moab. Get yourself husbands. God has afflicted me. I have nothing. I have no husband. I have no sons. I'm out of it. I got nothing, and you should abandon me as soon as possible. Ruth does not. And she makes the very famous declaration, you know, about how, no, I'm not going to go back. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. She clearly is devoted to Naomi. She is Naomi. She sees her as being destitute. She has no one, and she's not going to leave her. She is going to try to take care of her. And I think the story doesn't ever really indicate specifically, but I think we are meant to take very seriously the language of your God will be my God, that she really has embraced Yahweh, the God of Naomi, as her God, that she is going to put her trust in him. I don't think it really makes sense otherwise. But what we do know of her is this concern that she's going to take care of her. She's going to Judah. It's a risky thing for her to do. She doesn't know what kind of reception she's going to have there. She is a Moabite. There's no reason why the Israelites should treat her with any particular consideration. And Naomi points out to her, look, I don't have any more sons, so we can't do this levirate marriage thing. You married one of my sons, he died. I can't have you marry another one so that you can have kids because I don't have any more sons. And even if I did now, I don't think I'm going to have any more sons. I'm not going to have any more kids. And even if I did, it's going to be a long time before they're old enough to be married to you. So I've got nothing to offer you. You really should go back. But Ruth is determined that she's going to go with her and take care of her. In Judah, we see Ruth going out to glean the fields behind the harvesters, which was a part of the law that the poor, you were supposed to leave. You know, don't strip everything. You drop something, leave it there so that the poor can come along afterwards and take care of themselves that way. But Boaz, when he hears who Ruth is struck by what he has heard about her, her faithfulness in caring for Naomi. And so he rewards her by letting her harvest along with the others, by feeding her. He really brings her in and makes her a part of his household in the sense that she's given the right to go along and not just pick up a few leavings, but actually go along with the rest. And her, he tells his servants, you don't bug her. Naomi hears about this, and she thinks, okay, this sounds very promising to me. So she tells Ruth to go lie down at his feet and uncover his feet and all that stuff. And presumably this is a cultural thing. It has significance. I don't know where it comes from, but clearly Boaz seems to understand what it's about when it happens. Boaz is pleased, again, with the character of Ruth. If she were only looking out for herself, she might do better to try to find some young guy to marry. Boaz is an older man, but he recognizes, again, that she's seeking him out on the basis of his being a kinsman redeemer for Naomi, and she's concerned about taking care of Naomi in that way. And again, he is struck by her character and faithfulness. And then we have this complexity. What she's asking him to do seems to involve the combination of the traditional kinsman redeemer in regard to redeeming the land, buy this land that Naomi has to sell, and yet also it involves the idea of marriage and raising up a child that will be in the line of the family that Ruth had married into, and in a way, really looking out for Naomi in that way. You could think in this situation, well, wouldn't what would be called for if it's the line of Elimelech that we're concerned with, why shouldn't Boaz be marrying Naomi? Because she's the widow of Elimelech. But again, it comes down to that question of Ruth is the one who's going to have kids, not Naomi. So Boaz points out that he's not the nearest relative. There is another who is more closely related. And so we don't see anything that I know of in the law in the Old Testament about this, but the way they seem to have worked this out is that they have this sort of right of first refusal thing, that the closest relative has the right to enter in and take on the responsibility of the kinsman redeemer by the land and so forth, but if he doesn't want to do it, he can pass it on to the next guy in line. We're not told in this, but I think there is kind of a hint in the fact that Boaz, and maybe this is not, I don't know, I was trying to figure out whether this was significant, but Boaz, after Ruth asks him this, he tells his servants, don't say anything about Ruth being involved in this. I think that Boaz is trying to set up the situation. He wants to take on this role. He wants to marry Ruth. He wants to take on the role of the kinsman redeemer because he sees her quality and he wants to do this. But he's not the one who's first in line for this. So I think he's already starting to plan how he's going to make sure that he ends up being the guy who does this and not the guy who has the right to it. This is the tricky part. We don't really have an explanation in the story of exactly what's going on. You could interpret it that Boaz just says, oh, well, yeah, I guess that is my responsibility. Of course, there's this other guy over here who does have it first. But if he doesn't, you know, I'll certainly consider it. But it seems more like the story is he wants to do it, but he knows that there's another guy who has the right first. But he's going to try to set it up in such a way that he doesn't end up taking it. Because what he does is he goes to that nearest relative, and he doesn't mention Ruth at all. He says, Naomi has this land and needs to be redeemed, and you're the first in line, so the question is, do you want it, or is it going to pass to me? And he says, oh, no, I'd like to do that. And then he says, oh, yeah, and I forgot to mention that you have to marry Ruth to go along with this. And at which point he backs up and says, oh, I might end up injuring my own inheritance if I do that. Well, what is it that's happened there? Again, it's not explained. It's not entirely clear what it is that's going on. But it seems possible that it's either the nearest kinsman had not thought that marriage was associated with it at all, or if he had considered that, yes, it would be the kinsman redeemer's role to enter in marriage as well, he hadn't gotten any farther than thinking that the one that you would end up marrying would be Naomi. Because Naomi is the one that's mentioned by Boaz. So, oh, okay, got to redeem the property, marry Naomi. All right, that's fine. Because the thing about Naomi is she's old, she's not going to have any kids, and that's not going to mess up my inheritance structure. But when Ruth comes into the picture now Ruth is a younger woman who's quite likely to have children, and if she has children, I mean, this is not what it says, but I think this may be what he's thinking, is now this starts to mess things up. Like, that son, if she has a son, that son ultimately will be the one that the property would go to. And it may be, this is where that picture of when you ask whose son it is, you have the nearest relative who's given a son in the name of Elimelech, it seems quite possible that the son would inherit Elimelech's stuff, but it may be equally true that he would also be eligible for some of the nearest kinsman's stuff, because he's his son after all as well. So in which case, that really would mess up his inheritance, because now his stuff is being funneled over to Ruth's side of things, and that's not what he was counting on. And so they pull this transaction, which is again another little interesting feature, the thing with the sandal. In Leviticus, the law says if the kinsman redeemer will not take on his role, you kind of throw this sandal at him and becomes known as the family with one sandal or something like that. I mean, it seems to be an insult, like you refuse to take on your role. In this case, there doesn't seem to be any insult involved with it. They seem to be quite ready to enter into this agreement that I'll pass on it and the next in line, Boaz, will take it. And he's not, it's just the sandal is just now this indication that I've passed the responsibility on. There doesn't seem to be any particular shame to it. It's just this is the way that they've worked out the deal. Okay, so at any rate, a reasonable way of taking the story, I think, is that Boaz, recognizing Ruth's quality, wants to marry her, but works it as best he can to make sure that the guy who has the first right of stepping in and doing it won't do it. So maybe not, but that seems reasonable to me. Okay, Boaz ends up marrying Ruth then, and notice that at the end of the story, there are two things that are emphasized. The first thing that is emphasized now is what is the result for Naomi? Remember, Naomi lost her husband and her sons, and she said, "The Lord has afflicted me," and Ruth has gone with her specifically to be her help. She wants to take care of her in the way that the sons that she no longer has can't. So what happens at the end? They say to Naomi, "Naomi, Ruth was better than seven sons to you." And we see her, Naomi, holding the child and nursing the child. It's not that it's taken away from Ruth or anything like that, I don't think. But it really is seen in this, the way the lineage is understood and everything. It really is understood that in a significant sense, even though Naomi, Ruth is a Moabite. She's not related to Naomi by blood or anything. But through this understanding of the role of the kinsman redeemer and everything, Naomi now is no longer destitute. She has a son of sorts in Ruth's son. And notice how people, I don't know if you picked this up, but people refer to him as her redeemer. It's the same word, if I'm remembering correctly, the child of Ruth has become Naomi's Goel, her kinsman redeemer. Now, because that child is the one who now has legitimized things for her, she has this male person in her line who preserves her place in society and can take care of her when he grows up, and so on. So the story ends up, although it's a happy ending for Ruth, the arc of the story is destitute Naomi, who in the end, had, through God's working through the character of Ruth and Boaz, ends up with now she has been redeemed. The second thing that's interesting at the end of the story, which I'm sure you guys talked about, is that little kicker at the end that it turns out that the child, Obed, is the father of Jesse, who is the father of David. And so it's presented here that Ruth, the Moabitess, has given birth to a child who gives birth to the father of David. So Ruth is part of the Davidic line, which is another unexpected, it's kind of that oh thing at the end that kind of puts the whole thing in perspective. Okay, so what's the story telling us? I see it as highlighting the supreme importance of a faithful character in the midst of life under the Mosaic covenant. Jack said rightly, I think, that Israel as a nation was called to live faithfully as a group, that the covenant was this thing that the whole nation was called to. And so there is this distinction we can make between the faithfulness of the nation, this is the time of the judges when this story is happening, and the nation as a whole was a mess. They went up and down and were constantly unfaithful and all kinds of terrible stuff going on. But here we have one faithful Moabite woman being used by God to rescue and redeem her Israelite mother-in-law. That it is, Naomi accuses God of afflicting her, but in the end God rescues her through the faithfulness of Ruth. And Ruth has turned her back on the Moabites and embraced the people of Yahweh, and she does so presumably because she believes in Yahweh and because she loves Naomi and wants to care for her. I think it is very important to the story that Ruth is a Moabite, that according to the law, Moabites don't have any part of this, but what we see in Ruth is a human being who completely renounces, she's saying, I am abandoning my people. I am no longer a Moabite. I am now an Israelite. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. And it's her faithfulness, in spite of the fact that she's a woman instead of the son that you need to really take care of you, and the fact that she's a Moabite instead of an Israelite, her act of faithful compassion is what drives the story. She makes this great declaration. She goes with Naomi, and Boaz, who is also a person of character, responds to her precisely because of her sacrificial faithfulness to Naomi. He's pleased with the idea of marrying her primarily because of the kind of person that she is. And in the end, God uses that situation to rescue Naomi from the destitution that she had charged God with bringing upon her at the beginning. And then ultimately you see the extent of the blessing that God's brought because Naomi and Ruth both are, in a sense, in the family line of King David. Okay, I should say a word about Daniel here. I don't think I need to say a lot in one sense. I don't think it's all that hard to understand what happens in Daniel unless you start talking about which part of the statue corresponds to which kingdom and that kind of stuff, and that wasn't really our purpose. So if you ended up talking about that in your group, that's fine, but that wasn't really probably the heart of what we wanted to talk about here. What we saw in Ruth was the triumph of a faithful person living in the land under the Mosaic covenant. What we see in Daniel is God displaying his faithfulness to a faithful Israelite, Daniel, in the midst of this judgment that God has brought upon Israel, where they are not in the land, where they are removed, where Daniel is living not in the land under the law. All of that is gone. He's under Babylonian law. He is at the whim of the rulers of the various kingdoms that have control over Israel, first Babylon and then the Medes and the Persians. But again, we see God using Daniel's character and wisdom and the way that it is recognized by the people that he's around. Ruth, in the midst of the political and economic situation that the law brought about in Judah, it is ultimately her personal faithfulness that is the thing that carries the day. And then Daniel, who has been removed from that situation, it is again his personal faithfulness that God is using to redeem the situation. Can't help but be striking the way people respond to Daniel in that story I've mentioned in our group. But I don't know why, but it's such a cool story. What happens when Daniel goes into the lion's den, the way the king is sort of tricked by evil people into a situation where he has to execute Daniel and he has to be thrown into the lion's den, but he doesn't want to do it because he knows the person of quality that Daniel is. And as Daniel's going in, he's saying, your God's going to take care of you, right, Daniel? He's going to make sure that nothing happens to you here, right? And then Daniel's in there, and all night he can't sleep. He's thinking about, oh, what's going to happen to Daniel, and he's all upset. And early in the morning, he rushes out first thing, and he goes and calls out, "So, Daniel, did God rescue you?" And Daniel says, "Yeah, he did." Okay, well, I don't know. There's just something really striking about that. The way that God is prevailing, even in the midst of a situation where the people of other gods have supposedly subdued and conquered the people of God, God's people are being taken care of. The foreign rulers are ending up writing declarations that say, hey, God is God, and all that kind of thing. And then, of course, as a side note, we can remember the vision of the statue in there, where here's Israel in captivity. One of the great powers of the earth has Israel under its thumb, and yet the vision is of the statue of the different great kingdoms, and yet ultimately there's the stone that is cut out without hands that destroys the whole thing, that the kingdom of God ultimately is going to prevail over all of it. Okay, so why did we look at these passages together? What are we doing here in looking at this? I can only speak for myself in answering this question, but here's how I think about it. Here's what I got out of it in the context that we're looking at this stuff. In both Ruth and Daniel, we see individuals living within existing political and economic realities. We see in Ruth, here's a people living out the various aspects of the Israelite law that have to do with property and so forth. The kinsman redeemer, the redemption of property, the right of the poor to glean the fields, the widow whose husband's line is preserved through marriage to a kinsman, and all of that. This is all a part of the law. And in one sense, I think when you look at those, it's important for us, the stuff that Jack said yesterday, it's important for us to be careful as we look at each of those practices, that even there, those practices, for instance, the idea of redeeming the land, that yes, there is an element of this is a compassionate thing. The person is not ultimately losing the land and so forth. But there really does seem to be an element to it that is about God preserving his people as his people in the land that he gave them, that is unique, that it doesn't necessarily carry over to us as we try to figure out how should we set up our economic realities. But notice, I think ultimately it is not those laws that mattered the most. It was the personal faithfulness of Ruth to Yahweh and to Naomi. Notice that there's that nearest relative who was uninterested in helping. When he found out that he might end up losing financially by getting involved in this deal, he didn't want to have anything to do with it. That presumably was in the context, the way things they had worked out, that was an option that he had available to him. It takes ultimately, very much like what David was saying today about any economic system, it takes people of character to make it work. And what we see in the story of Ruth is in the given socioeconomic realities that she was facing, she had the right as a person who was poor to go out and glean after the harvesters, but in fact she ended up with much more because of the kind of character that she had. And Daniel is very much the same sort of situation. He is under none of the protections of the legal system that God had set up for the preserving of the poor and all of that kind of stuff. But again, he has the opportunity to be personally faithful. And like Ruth, he ends up commanding respect and somewhat redeems the situation in which he finds himself. Notice that in each of these situations, I think it is very much implied ultimately that it is the sovereign purposes of God that are being worked out. Even in Ruth, where God isn't mentioned a lot, I think the overarching theme, and when you get to that kicker at the end, and hey, this happens to be the grandfather of David, we can see the way that God had been working through the whole thing to bring about his ultimate purposes, and very much the same thing in Daniel. Even in captivity, even where the blessing and protections of God's law are all gone, it is the faithful person ultimately, the one who relies on God, who is going to prevail. As it happens, he actually prevails in a concrete way temporally there. But in both cases, I think it is the message is of the importance of the character of the individual, that person who will put their trust in God. And so for us as Christians, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I take out of the story. I think we are called on to see things in the same way. We may, by the grace of God, have the opportunity to live in a country where the political and economic life of our country is vital and reasonable and productive and secure. Or we may live in a country where political and economic life is deteriorating, where freedom and security are disappearing. I don't know how such a thing as that could happen. Ultimately, though, either situation is really about the opportunity for the people of God to live as the people of God. That's what I take away from it, is that whatever economic reality we find ourselves in, we have the opportunity to be faithful, to be people who are looking to God to fulfill his promises. And in the end, I think that's where the real significance lies. I'm very much of the opinion that the emphasis in the Bible from beginning to end is on the decisions that each of us as individuals have to make about how we are going to interrelate with God and each other. That I am called on to decide whether God is real, his values are right, his people are my people, and I'm going to love them and care for them. Those are the questions that are important. So I do tend to think that the biblical picture is there are certainly economic principles that make more sense than others. But in real life, what we're really dealing with is what decision am I going to make about how I'm going to live, whatever economic reality I find myself in. I think that's something like what we had in mind when we chose these passages to look at, although I could be mistaken about that. Okay, so we're supposed to have questions and answers now.
David, question for you. Regarding your observation this morning about Adam Smith, just your passing observation, but I heard it. Were you suggesting that Adam Smith's theories, interesting, worked fairly well, perhaps during his time frame, but once we got into industrialization and the problems that went along with industrialization, that Smith's theories would not work as well in that sort of a situation?
Yeah. The principles that he has laid out, I think, for the most part, are good. They really describe the way a simple economic system works well, principles by which a simple economic system can work well. But I remember studying when I took economics in college, the first day of class, the model that was presented was essentially the Adam Smith's model, for the most part. Three assumptions: unlimited greed, limited resources, freedom of information. All of those are assumptions on which that model needs in order to work well. The unlimited greed, that one still holds. Limited resources, it still holds. But something like information, free flow of information. Do I have at my fingertips all of the information that I need in order to make sound economic decisions? I'd say no, I don't. Things are really complex. And a lot of that information might be somewhere available to me. Some of that would not be available to me no matter what. But even what is available, is there's a lot of stuff that has to be sorted out, more than I can. Adam Smith's system is on the principle of free competition, a level playing field. We're far from that. What parts of our economy, is it really true that it's a level playing field? Farming, not with price support, not with the kinds of aid that's gone to various kinds of crops and stuff for them to not raise them and that sort of thing. Things have changed a lot since Adam Smith, and the principles are still at work, but things are really complicated.
But I guess fundamentally, are the problems with the principles or are the problems with other things that have come into play? When you use farming as an example, well, that isn't a problem with Adam Smith's principles. That's
right.
A problem with
right.
Government intervention
right.
into the whole thing.
That's right.
So,
but the reality is, and part of it is things other than government interference, it is a much more complex and a much bigger world than was Adam Smith's. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot that I don't know that's happening in the rest of the world that has an impact on me and that would be information that I would need to make intelligent decisions economically.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I would agree with that. I guess I'm a simple man. I actually never took an economics class in college or anything like that, and we'll get into this more when we talk about Keynes tomorrow, is I like the idea of finding some relatively simple basic principles that I can go back to, rather than, seems to me as though one of the things Keynes is saying is, if you have a smart enough person or smart enough people figuring out how and when to intervene, everything will be fine.
Right.
To which I would say, well, then we are in a hopeless situation, as opposed to looking for more fundamental principles, our Smith's principles or Keynes' principles, looking for more fundamental principles that I can keep trying to go back to. I might not get there, and our country or other economies might not get there, but what set of principles are the ones that, the ones I should try to adhere to?
And I would basically agree. I think that Adam Smith has charted out some principles that are very helpful. They're very astute observations and things that have been done to try to countermand some of those principles that he's talking about, I think have led to greater detriment than good. I think that's absolutely true. But Adam Smith was writing in a time when the economy was simpler. Things are much more complex. The fact that they're more complex leads me to think that it's even harder to have a centralized control of the economy than at the time of Adam Smith. But we are living in a very different environment than Adam Smith experienced.
I don't know if I really have a question. I was just thinking, it seems to be a constant thing with faith that I run to more and more in the Bible, that it's these people, the emphasis being on the decision before themselves and God, and not so much the outcome. They're just meant to obey, and the future is kind of unknown. And in so obeying, it's God just blows minds and does something completely random and like something they could have never planned. And out of that comes a physical blessing, like with, you know, land yielding more crops or a physical line being pushed forward. I'm more of thinking, I'll obey, and it'd be nice to have those physical things, but I can't expect that, but I know there will be victory. But I'm wondering, what kind of importance do you think is placed on the physical side? Is it more of a metaphor that things will work out? And sometimes they do physically, but does that make sense? Or I still kind of get like hazy on those things, especially with these stories where the physical side, it's like, oh, well, everyone sees that it works out physically, so that's more of a testament to God. But what about the times where just God just comes and kills everybody, and it's just like, I don't know.
I think that what's going on there is that for the sake of the story, it's important that God's blessing on the decision that was made becomes manifest. It's not saying every time you act in a way that is faithful, that you will be rewarded in materially. But what it's saying is, in this story, someone acted faithfully and God rewarded them, and here is evidence of that reward. So I don't think it's a guarantee of reward. It's just the way God wanted to make manifest the fact that was a good and right thing that person did.
I agree with that. There are a couple other factors that come into it, I think, especially when we're looking, well, in all of the stories in the Old Testament, I think. We come back again to this idea that God has made this particular covenant with Israel, and physical blessing was a part of the covenant. I mean, the idea that I will be your God and you will be my people. God has said, in essence, at times the language of the kinsman redeemer is used of God himself. Basically, I'm the one who's going to look out for you. And the idea that the blessings and the curses that Moses spelled out to Israel, much of that was put in terms of physical blessing in the sense of will you prosper or will your enemies prevail over you and all of that sort of thing. So when God makes a promise that has a physical, concrete manifestation in the world, then to see him keep that promise and to reward in a physical way is to see him being faithful to what he has actually said that he will do. What we find in the New Testament is the emphasis has shifted to, I mean, not that it was ever not there, but it has become clearer to us in the promises of the gospel that the ultimate faithfulness that we're concerned with is God's promise to redeem our life in the end, that our eternal destiny and all of that is what's important. You can kind of see that, we were talking about in our group, the thing in Hebrews that talks about the champions of faith in the Old Testament. Some of them are described as having prospered, and some of them are described as having died and been sawn in half and all this kind of stuff. And yet all of them are faithful, and all of them were looking forward to the promise that God had made. So I think that we, as we look at our own lives, we just know that God deals with us in both of those ways. That there are times when we cry out to God and he responds in a tangible way to us. And it's a kind thing for God to do that to us because it reminds us that he is faithful and that we're right to turn to him. But sometimes we cry out to God and the thing we cry out for we don't get, and in fact things get worse. And in that situation we are called upon to remember that God never promised that things wouldn't be bad for me right now. What he promised is that everything is working for my good and that he will redeem my life ultimately. So, yeah, where we are now is I have no promise that I'm going to be physically blessed, I'm going to be secure or wealthy or whatever if I trust in God, but it may very well be that God will demonstrate his kindness by sending a blessing like that so that I would know it. That's how I think.
I was just going to say real quick, too, maybe from hearing Jack talk about the promise being just for Israel, a lot of those, the covenant, and we're not a part of that. Could it be so, too, that they're entitled to physical blessings through obeying God, where we're not? With the people of Sodom, too, I mean, those were New Testament people, but I mean, as far back as like Abraham and patriarchs and all those faithful people, it's just a thought.
Well, I think as a nation, they were entitled in the sense that God had made a promise, I will bless you as a nation if you as a nation are faithful. And we have not, as we think about the economic realities of the United States, we can't draw on that promise. We can't say, God, if we will all be faithful, you will preserve the United States from its enemies and give us prosperity. We don't have a promise that that's the case. So in that sense, yeah, they have a promise that we don't have.
David, in your closing remarks on Marxism, I believe you characterized, correct me if I'm misremembering, but you characterized it as stupid, or not Marxism, but communism. And I could imagine that calling it like hubristic, very, very like arrogant, probably very naive, could be very appropriate. Stupid seems to be a little, perhaps a little unfair, like the Marxist think or the socialist thinkers that led up to communism, like were very intelligent.
David didn't call it stupid. If I remember, it was Jesus who was calling it stupid.
Oh, that's right. Well, I was wondering if you could shed some light on Jesus' choice of vocabulary there.
Was there a question, or are you just commenting on that?
Oh, it was a question. If you could shed some light on your choice of, or yours and Jesus' choice of vocabulary.
Yeah, there are smart people that are Marxists and have been Marxists. I think Karl Marx was a smart person. So in that sense, it's not stupid. But it is, as a perspective, I think it has lost track of reality and what human beings are. And I can understand how it got there, but it has gone quite a ways from reality as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it was based on very different assumptions, like the probably like the perfectibility of man and this whole dialectic notion of history. And like with that as an assumption, it seems like in a humanistic sense, there's a very like noble, optimistic kind of flavor to it all, and misguided. Like I certainly agree that like communism is like a very misguided ideology, but I don't know.
Well, I think, I don't know how firmly I want to defend the word stupid, but one could have a philosophy of life that's built on really bad assumptions that follows from it that's humanistic and all that sort of thing and still be stupid. Because if the assumptions are really bad assumptions, the end result is going to be a stupid philosophy. And I don't know that I want to defend stupid very vociferously, but it's very naive. It's very misdirected.
I'm comfortable with that.
In reading Adam Smith, you talked about the model that you got in your economics class and the three assumptions. The first one was unlimited greed. I haven't read enough Adam Smith, but in the part that we read, I wouldn't have said that his system requires unlimited greed. Could you expand on that?
Well, what it means, unlimited greed, what they mean is that more demand, there's always more requirement for resources than you have resources to meet. If there are enough resources to respond to every one of our desires or needs, you no longer have an economic problem. Because economics is, how are we going to ration limited resources? How are we going to ration the resources that we have, given that the need for those is greater than what we have? If everything that everybody ever wanted could be provided for, we don't need economics.
Well, unlimited greed seems like a pejorative way to describe that.
Yeah, that's not the word they used in the economics class. It's unlimited want is the word that they used.
Okay.
But I like to dress it up a little.
So human beings have flexible desires.
They have desires beyond what can be met in a finite universe.
I have two comments. One is, thank you. The other one is about the question that was asked about physical rewards. And I guess I just want to share my experience, which is that I would rather be in control and have shitty circumstances than let God be in control and give me stuff, personally. So that's just felt applicable. Well, okay, so the question was, are there physical rewards to being obedient to God? And my experience is that if I am obedient and I'm asking for something and I actually receive it, I tend to feel scared and very small. Like, it's actually scary for me. Like, wow, God's really big. And it's sometimes more comfortable for me to try to make things happen on my own and not have them work out, but still keep trying because I feel like I'm in control. And I just thought I would say that. Thanks.
I had a question actually kind of along those lines about both the faithfulness in Daniel and Ruth, because in our group we had a little kind of mini comment discussion about, is faithfulness about kind of accepting the circumstances that God has placed you in, being faithful in that way, and it's kind of more of a passive thing or a relaxed, trusting kind of thing, or can it also be an active, visionary, I hope for this thing, and I'm striving for it because it seems that God is wanting this. And it seems like that's also a theme in some of the things, that the economic themes that we're looking at, where Marxism has a vision of what it's aiming for that some people could see as a Christian ideal, that we're trying to have everybody have enough resources, and we're trying to have connected communities and things like that. It may have gone astray, but there's sort of a vision, perhaps a lack of faithfulness. I don't know. But could you, either of you guys, comment on that? I felt like that was sort of similar to these comments.
Well, let me start with something. For me, I always start with what I think I see in the text. And I would say that the thing is that in each of these situations, it seems to me both for Ruth and Daniel, they're put in a specific situation. Ruth is looking at this. Naomi is going to go off, and she has nobody to take care of her. Daniel is in the situation where he is being asked to do things that are against what he thinks God has called him to do in his religious life. And so in both of those situations, the choice before them is fairly clear. To be faithful is, even though it's scary, I'm going to go with Naomi to Judah because I'm not concerned just for myself, I'm concerned for her as well. So that seems to me like a different kind of decision than to say, I'm going to take it upon myself to craft an economic system that brings more benefit to the world. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's a little trickier to associate that with the concept of faithfulness or not, because I tend to be fairly focused on faithful to what? I mean, who am I trusting, and what am I being asked to do, and what am I being faithful to, and that kind of thing. So it just gets trickier on the economic level, I think. I have trouble sometimes when Christian political thinkers say, this is the obvious political implication of being a disciple of Jesus. I think we ought to embrace every genuine political implication of being a follower of Jesus, but it has to come back to that question, have I really understood what I'm being called to as a disciple? What am I being faithful to in that way? So, yeah, we ought to be faithful in all ways, but I'm a from-the-ground kind of guy. I can see this far as to what I'm being called upon to do as a believer. You tell me that this big vision over here I'm called upon to do, well, there's a lot of steps between here and there, and
tell me again, how did we get there? How did that become what faithfulness looked like? And that's where I get it's a little harder. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
In my experience, faith is always active. That is to say, there's always energy expended, because to be faithful generally calls on me to do a lot of preaching to myself and reminding myself of what's true. So in that sense, it seems to me it's always active. But what you're asking is, should faith manifest itself with some kind of outward activity or direction or goal? And I think the answer to that is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes it's just a recognition that I am without the resources to really address the problem at hand. And I'm at God's mercy, and there's really nothing at this point that I can see that I could do to be helpful. There are other times when you see, well, here's an opportunity. Maybe this is the solution to the problem. Maybe this is the way out of this. But even when that's the case, I think we have to pursue that in humility, because I may be wrong. We'll just go this direction, and we'll see what happens.
In trying to understand Marx a bit better, in reading his critique of the division of labor, and Adam Smith's explanation of the division of labor was really helpful to kind of fill out what Marx was concerned about. He critiques it because it's dehumanizing. But I think the picture that people have in their heads is that that means, therefore, that because the division of labor is dehumanizing, therefore we should all go back to craftsmanship, live in our little communities, and sing around the fire at night, when really he's actually advocating it in the end. I was just wondering if you could fill that out a bit, because he's not trying to get rid of technique, and he's not trying to get rid of the things that the industrialization brought in regarding to. So can you kind of give more of a picture of what he's thinking regarding those things which he specifically critiques as being dehumanizing?
Well, in the Communist Manifesto, if you look at it closely, Marx is actually very impressed with what capitalism has accomplished, that the productivity that has come along is phenomenal, and all the innovation and stuff that it has spurred he finds amazing. And that's what's made the plenty possible. But as he sees it, within that system, there are built in these contradictions, as he will call them, these antagonisms, these tensions, and we need to progress beyond that through a revolution to a place where those are all gone. And when those are all gone, you won't have no factories. You'll still have factories, but you'll have people whistling while they work, because people aren't alienated from that which they produce. So he wants to use everything that capitalism has brought into being, but we've got a different environment such that we won't have the same kinds of contradictions and tensions.
So you still may have people in the pin factory making pins. It's just that now they're not doing it for the capitalist master over them.
Right. But you may not have people making pins either. I think Marx would say, I'm not sure exactly what it'll look like. But when we get there, the working class will know what to do to take care of that, the inhumanity of this process problem.
To go back to Ruth for a second. In the context of Ruth, are we to the point in the history of the Israelites where polygamy is no longer assumed as appropriate? It seemed to be kind of, we were assuming that in our conversation, but we never spelled it out. I was wondering. It kind of puts a different color on things.
We certainly have examples later on of men with more than one wife. And, yeah, this is before Saul, before David.
I don't know. I have never looked into this question, the extent of the practice of polygamy at any, even at those times when we see it happening. Was it a widespread phenomenon? How did the culture think about it at large? We face that practical question, like with the near kinsman of Ruth there. Did he already have a wife and kids? And would that have been it? And I don't know how to answer that question myself.
It almost seems like if he's already got inheritance plans going, he's already got somebody else there. Either he was married or is married or something along those lines.
All I can say is it seems possible to me that he was.
Yeah, thanks.